The world reacts to Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin's potential deal.
No nation on the planet, nobody, should be helping Mr. Putin kill innocent Ukrainians. And if they decide to move forward with some sort of arms deal, well, obviously we'll take the measure of that, and we'll deal with it appropriately.
Plus, now that the G20 is behind us, how did Ukraine do?
Despite what is a bold act of aggression, most countries in the world have basically said, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're not going to sanction Russia.
And later in the program, more Ukrainian attacks on Crimea, and a gourmet chef feeds Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines. Today is Thursday, September 14th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today with a late-breaking story from Moscow. Russia is expelling two U.S. diplomats. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Russia has ordered two U.S. diplomats to leave the country within 7 days, accusing them of keeping in touch with a man in Russia who worked at the U.S. consulate in Vladivostok, but was arrested earlier this year. The ex-employee was accused of collecting information for U.S. diplomats about Russia's military action in Ukraine and related issues. The two U.S. diplomats ordered to leave are the first secretary at the U.S. Embassy in Russia, Jeffrey Sillin, and the second secretary, David Bernstein. Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement that the U.S. ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy, has been informed of this and told that what it called the illegal activities of the U.S. diplomatic mission are unacceptable. And the Moscow expects Washington to, quote, refrain from confrontational steps. I'm Rita Foley.
We'll take a look back at the G20 summit in India in a few minutes, but the other diplomatic story making news this week is the meeting in Russia between Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. They met on Wednesday at Russia's most advanced spaceport amid warnings from the U.S. and South Korea against a potential arms transfer. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has that story.
Visiting North Korean leader Kim Jong-un got the royal treatment, including a personal tour by President Vladimir Putin of Russia's most advanced space rocket launch site in that country's Far East. The two leaders reportedly discussed the possibility of sending a North Korean cosmonaut into space, and Kim asked detailed questions about rockets. After the meeting, Putin told Russian state television that there are possibilities for military cooperation with North Korea despite international sanctions. For his part, Kim said he would make ties with Russia his number one priority and made clear he supports Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying, "We have always expressed full and unconditional support for all the measures taken by the Russian government and President Putin." While Putin and Kim toasted their burgeoning military cooperation, the talks raised concerns in Washington. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby had this to say.
No nation on the planet, nobody, should be helping Mr. Putin kill innocent Ukrainians. And if they decide to move forward with some sort of arms deal, well, obviously we'll take the measure of that and we'll deal with it appropriately.
The meeting also caused concern at the State Department, according to spokesperson Matthew Miller.
I would say it is troubling when you see the Russians talking about cooperating with North Korea on programs that would violate UN Security Council resolutions that Russia itself voted for.
One expert told VOA that North Korea and Russia apparently struck a deal that is a win for them, but troubling for the global order and regional stability. Mark Fitzpatrick is with the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
Yeah, I think this is very significant that they met at a space center, and it's an indication that this is the kind of technology that North Korea wants, given that its last two spy satellites, both satellite launches, failed. North Korea is in need of such assistance.
Fitzpatrick told VOA that he has no doubt that North Korea will supply artillery shells and anti-tank shells, which will certainly help Russia in Ukraine because it has depleted its arsenal. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Wednesday that any form of cooperation of any country with North Korea must respect the sanctions regime that was imposed by the Security Council. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Now that the G20 has wrapped up, how did it go for Ukraine? And is a lack of consensus a sign of disagreement among world powers, or are they simply hedging their bets? Charles Kupchin is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University.
Well, I think the main news to come out of the G20 was that the declaration agreed upon by the participants was not quite as forward-leaning as it was last year. Rather silent on the conflict, noting the suffering that's taking place as a consequence of the war, but not going much beyond that. And I think that's simply a function of the fact that there was no consensus among the G20 members to go further than that. And in some ways, the G20 was reverting to a more traditional agenda of not just dealing with the crisis of the day, but trying to look down the road. And it envisaged a new corridor from India to the Middle East, which I think was meant to be a counter to China's Belt and Road Initiative, and focused a lot on issues of development, funding of the multilateral institutions, looking to get more development assistance and debt relief for the developing world.
So are you saying that the members of the G20 couldn't agree or simply chose to table the subject?
Both. I think that given that the G20 moves by consensus and that it is an inclusive organization that brings together countries from the global north, from the global south, countries representing the world's democracies as well as the world's autocracies, it was very difficult to get a consensus on what is probably the most divisive issue of the moment, and that is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I do think that many members around the table are none too enthusiastic about the war, know full well that Russia's invasion constitutes an act of aggression, breaches international law, breaches the UN Charter. But I also think that they are, in many respects, keeping their powder dry, envisaging a world in which they now have options, tilting toward the West, tilting toward Russia and China. I think that's an indicator of what's to come. A much more fluid world, a world of multi-alignment in which India one day sides with the U.S. and the next day with the Russians. This is, I think, an indicator of a global system that is transitioning to a much more what I would call polycentric world than the one that we're used to.
You mentioned India just now. Are there other countries whose allegiances you see as fungible?
Yes, I would say most of the world that isn't clearly aligned with one bloc or the other. India is, for example, increasing its ties to the United States. The Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, was here in the U.S. not long ago, feted with a state dinner. But India isn't sanctioning Russia. India is buying arms from Russia. India has not only become a leader in the G20 and what's called the Quad, a new semi-formal grouping of the U.S., India, Australia, Japan to counter China, but they have joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a body that is headed by Russia and China. They are in the BRICS, an organization of emerging countries that has just added new members, and it sees itself as a counterweight to the U.S. Biden, after Delhi, went to Vietnam. He upgraded the U.S. relationship with Vietnam, but Vietnam is a country that also has very strong ties to Russia and China. I think one could go around the world, Argentina, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, South Africa. These are all countries that are in some ways hedging their bets, looking to the West on Tuesday, looking to Russia and China on Wednesday. And that's why I do think that the U.S. needs to get ready for a world that is really much more complicated than the one that we've been in since the U.S. emerged as a major power in World War II.
Going back to the days before the G20 in India, would you have been or are you surprised at the lack of consensus on Ukraine that came out of that meeting?
No. I think that it is striking that really going back to the beginning of the war, many countries have been sitting on the fence. In some ways, it is perhaps one of the most surprising takeaways that despite what is a bald act of aggression, most countries in the world have basically said, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're not going to sanction Russia. We're not going to clearly side with either the U.S.-led coalition or the Russia-China coalition. And so it is not a surprise to me. I do think that Russia is on its back foot, that many countries around the world recognize that Russia has really breached international protocol. It is, a setback for the Russian economy, for the Russian people. But the bottom line here is that there really isn't a pathway to building a broader global coalition when it comes to Ukraine. And that's why Ukraine is spending a lot of its time and effort appealing to the American people, to Europeans, to others, to continue the economic and military support. And I think that support is likely to continue. But in some ways, the most important battlegrounds right now are not in the global south, not winning over or trying to win over the Saudis, the Egyptians, the South Africans, the Nigerians, but making sure that the West stays strong. And here in the United States, we are seeing a fairly sizable right-wing constituency in the Republican Party that is beginning to raise questions about how much aid should continue to flow to Ukraine. So when it comes to the war, when it comes to supporting Ukraine, I think the most important thing to watch is domestic politics in the U.S., domestic politics in France and Germany. That's in some ways where I think the key decisions will be made in the months ahead.
Charles Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. Professor, thanks for your analysis today.
My pleasure.
The U.S. government on Thursday imposed sanctions on some 150 companies and individuals that it's accused of helping Russia's war effort against Ukraine. Details now from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
The Departments of State and Treasury have announced a new round of sweeping sanctions on those the U.S. government accuses of sanctions evasion and circumvention to help Russia wage war against Ukraine. Of particular focus is Russia's energy industry, with sanctions targeting the country's energy production and export capacity, as well as Russia's metal and mining sectors. Action is also being taken against manufacturers of cruise missiles and other weapons used by Russia to target Ukrainian cities. Also sanctioned are those affiliated with the Wagner Group militia, alleged to have shipped munitions from North Korea to Russia, and those helping advance Russian malign activities in the Central African Republic. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
We meet a Ukrainian gourmet chef preparing food for soldiers in a few minutes. Now, there has been another damaging Ukrainian attack in Crimea. I'm joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for the latest.
We can consider this as confirmation because due to, as we discussed yesterday, it was a massive attack apparently by Ukrainian forces, but it was not confirmed. However, there were rumors that one submarine and one warship was were destroyed. And today in the morning, every morning report by General Staff, we see that the General Staff of Ukraine added one submarine and one warship on the list of destroyed equipment of the Russian forces, meaning we can consider this as confirmation.
Sort of an indirect confirmation that Ukraine is responsible for the destruction.
Well, yes, indirect confirmation by the General Staff. So they did not comment on the attack itself, or they did not disclose any details. They just added this new information on the list of destroyed equipment.
And that was the attack earlier this week. I understand there's been another attack on Crimea. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it was another attack in the early hours of September 14th, during the night. Again, we have certain confirmation that Ukraine is involved, and this confirmation goes from the speaker of the South Frontline, from the official representative of the South Frontline press office, Natalia Humenyuk. She was commenting the explosions in Yevpatoria, in Crimea. This is exactly where this happened. And she said that the attack was happening on the military objects and locations where military equipment is, Russian military equipment is currently located, and it was happening next to the military airport. This is official targets for Ukrainian forces.
And do we know the results of the attack?
Well, according to Ukrainian media outlets, this we cannot consider this as direct confirmation, but it looks like this would be confirmed as well. It was Ukrainian forces managed to destroy one of the air defense systems that was locating there, and a couple of more equipment. And according again to this indirect confirmed information, Ukrainian forces used Neptune missiles, which is Ukraine produced, as well as apparently drones as well.
And with the sinking of the ships in Sevastopol, with what we just talked about in Yevpatoria, with the oil rigs earlier, is there a renewed sense of optimism in Kyiv about these victories from the sea?
Well, I should say, and this is also, you know, what's mentioned by Ukrainian officials, that more to come in Crimea. I should say that this here in Kyiv, this feels like, you know, finally there is a result of certain actions which were not announced and which were never confirmed by Ukrainian officials, because we were hearing a lot that Ukrainian intelligence and together with Ukrainian security service and Ukrainian armed forces doing something and preparing something and might be doing something on the territory of Crimea. And we've seen some confirmations with the explosions that were happening before. And now we can definitely feel that this is like yet another result of this long-term work.
And we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Where is it written that army food can't be delicious? Today we meet Serhii. He graduated from a culinary school in central Ukraine with dreams of working in a Michelin-starred restaurant. But for now, with his country locked in a war against Russia, he's only too happy to feed the troops as an army cook. Reuters' Sean Hogan has his story.
The front line is just over there, so it is a shame not to cook good food here.
Serhii is in the country's central Dnipropetrovsk region, He says it feels far removed from the top city restaurants he's previously worked in across Ukraine and Poland.
Cooking over an open fire at the makeshift kitchen and at the restaurant are two entirely different worlds, two different levels of cooking. It was very difficult in the beginning, but that's all right. As time passes, we develop and move forward.
As a father of three, he's exempt from serving on the front lines himself, but he was happy to volunteer his culinary skills to the cause. With lots of mouths to feed, his meals are carefully crafted. It's a winning formula. The troops have given Serhii's menu their seal of approval.
Magicians work here. One used to work at the restaurant for 9 years. Another one worked for 10 years. How could it not be tasty? Try it yourself and you'll have an idea. It's delicious.
That's Reuters' Sean Hogan reporting. And finally, today, at least one local bookstore in Washington says people want to read more Ukrainian books. Such interest has risen dramatically after the start of Russia's invasion and hasn't faded. Irina Shankarenko has the story, narrated for us today by Anna Rice.
Leland Fowler with Kramer's Bookstore in the heart of Washington, D.C., proudly shows one of the latest store arrivals. The English translation of a book by Ukrainian photographer and writer Yevgeny Belarusets, telling the stories of Ukrainians after Russia's invasion. There are many more titles like this, a myriad of books by Ukrainian authors translated into English.
For the past year, there's been a lot more interest in Ukrainian authors. We have one book that is an anthology of fiction written by Ukrainians. And that is very popular because people are just interested in what life is like there.
Fowler is head book buyer at Kramer's, and she says there are a few authors whose books keep going out of stock. One of them is Ukrainian historian Serhii Plohy.
They really wanted to know about the background, so they bought The Gates of Europe a lot to know the background of the relationship between the two countries.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, Kramer's had a special display dedicated to the war. As a result, the store managers like Andrew Jones say books about Russia's history and Putin have also been popular lately.
We made a display of Ukrainian history books as well as many Russian history books, specifically ones that kind of focus on that cultural personality of Putin. And it sold very well for about 3 months.
Fowler says before the war, the store wasn't selling books by Ukrainian authors at all. Today, however, they pay close attention to the authors they pick.
Before the invasion, I didn't think about where an author was from, Russia or Ukraine. Didn't think about nationality, just thought about the book. Afterwards, I started thinking about the nationality because I knew that that was going to be of interest to my customers.
As a result, Ukrainian authors have gained access to a relatively closed U.S. book market, says Oleg Katsuba with the Harvard University's Ukrainian Research Institute.
First of all, until recently, people knew very little about Ukraine. They didn't know Ukraine has a rich and diverse culture, literature, books, etc. On top of that, the Ukrainian government hasn't done much to popularize Ukrainian writers and Ukrainian literature. Only recently, there's been work done to change that.
It's unclear if the popularity of Ukrainian authors translates outside of the diplomatic and political hub of Washington, D.C. But at least here, Americans want to know more about the country that continues to defy a Russian invasion. For Irina Shankarenko and Irina Matveychuk in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.